Words are a dime a dozen. Everyone knows that in the heat of an argument, we will say anything to support our cause. We will quote the Bible, refer to unverifiable statistics. Who can be persuaded by bags of air like that? Action and demonstration are much more powerful and meaningful. They are there before our eyes for us to see.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
It's Violet Benson, your favorite meme queen and the big sis you didn't ask for, but need. Welcome to Almost Adulting.
Almost Adulting. Almost Adulting.
Are you ready?
Hi, besties, and welcome to a brand new Almost Adulting, the largest self-help podcast and movement, your number one destination for personal growth and mental health. I'm your big sister and your host, Violetta Benson. I feel like saying my last name today. So welcome to a brand new Benson Book Club. As you are aware, I am writing a book this year. So excited about it. So since I'm writing a book this year, I've decided to dedicate all of my Tuesday episodes this year to my Benson Book Club. This is basically where I will be sharing some of my favorite books with you, some of my favorite chapters from those books, books that I'm either already read or that I'm currently reading. And I just want to share them with you because I think there's a lot of knowledge. So basically, just every Tuesday, you just learn so much from just 30 minutes. You are welcome. But I learn a lot as well. So, okay, without further ado, today we will be covering How to Win Arguments from the book, The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene. I'm excited. Law number 9, win through your actions, never through argument. Any momentary triumph that you think you have gained through argument is really a pyrrhic victory. The resentment and ill will you stir up is stronger and lasts longer than any momentary change of opinion. It is much more powerful to get others to agree with you through your actions without saying a word. Demonstrate, do not explicate. In 1502 in Florence, Italy, an enormous block of marble stood in the works department of the Church of Santa Maria del Fiore. It had once been a magnificent piece of raw stone, but an unskilled sculptor had mistakenly bored a hole through it where there should have been a figure's leg, generally mutilating it. Piero Soderini, Florence's mayor, had contemplated trying to save the block by commissioning Leonardo da Vinci to work on it or some other master, but had given up since everyone agreed that the stone had been ruined. So, despite the money that had been wasted on it, it gathered dust in the dark halls of the church. This was where things stood until some Florentine friends of the great Michelangelo decided to write to the artist, then living in Rome. He alone, they said, could do something with the marble, which was still magnificent raw material. Michelangelo traveled to Florence, examined the stone, and came to the conclusion that he could, in fact, carve a fine figure from it by adapting the pose to the way the rock had been mutilated. Soderini argued that this was a waste of time. Nobody could salvage such a disaster. But he finally agreed to let the artist work on it. Michelangelo decided he would depict a young David, a sling in hand. Weeks later, as Michelangelo was putting the final touches on the statue, Soderini entered the studio. Fancying himself a bit of a connoisseur, he studied the huge work and told Michelangelo that, while he thought it was magnificent, the nose, he judged, was too big. Michelangelo realized that Soderini was standing in a place right under the giant figure and did not have the proper perspective. Without a word, he gestured for Soderini to follow him up the scaffolding. Reaching the nose, he picked up his chisel, as well as a bit of marble dust that lay on the planks. With Soderini just a few feet below him on the scaffolding, Michelangelo started to tap lightly with the chisel, letting the bits of dust he had gathered in his hands to fall little by little. He actually did nothing to change the nose, but he gave every appearance of working on it. After a few minutes of this charade, he stood aside. "Look at it now." "I like it better," replied Soderini. "You've actually made it come alive." Michelangelo knew that by changing the shape of the nose, he might ruin the entire sculpture. Yet Soderini was a man who prided himself on his aesthetic judgment. To offend such a man by arguing would not only gain Michelangelo nothing, but it would put future commissions in jeopardy. Michelangelo was too clever to argue. His solution was to change Soderini's perspective, aka literally bring him closer to the nose, without making him realize that this was the cause of the misperception. Fortunately for posterity, Michelangelo found a way to keep the perception of the statue intact while, at the same time, making Soderini believe that he had improved it. Such is the double power of winning through actions rather than argument. No one is offended and your point is proven. So, what is this, the keys to power? Well, in the realms of power, you must learn to judge your moves by their long-term effects on other people. The problem in trying to prove a point or gain a victory through argument is that in the end, you can never be certain how it affects the people you're arguing with. They may appear to agree with you politely, but inside, they may resent you. Or perhaps something you said inadvertently even offends them. Words have that insinuous ability to be interpreted according to the other person's mood and insecurities. Even the best arguments have no solid foundation. For we have all come to distrust that slippery nature of words. And days after agreeing with some, we often revert to our old opinion out of sheer habit. So understand this. Words are a dime a dozen. Everyone knows that in the heat of an argument, we will say anything to support our cause. We will quote the Bible, refer to unverifiable statistics. Who can be persuaded by bags of air like that? Action and demonstration are much more powerful and meaningful. They are there before our eyes for us to see. Yes, now the statue's nose does look just right. There are no offensive words, no possibility of misinterpretation. No one can argue with the demonstrated proof. As Baltasar Garcian remarks, the truth is generally seen, rarely heard. Sir Christopher Wren was England's version of a Renaissance man. He had mastered the science of mathematics, astronomy, physics, and sociology. Yet, during his extremely long career as England's most celebrated architect, he was often told by his patrons to make impractical changes in his designs. Never once did he argue or offend. He had other ways of proving his point. In 1688, Rand designed a magnificent town hall for the city of Westminster. The mayor, however, was not satisfied. In fact, he was nervous. He told Rand he was afraid that the second floor was not secure and that it could all come crashing down on his office on the first floor. He demanded that Rand add two stone columns for extra support. Rand, the consummate engineer, knew that these columns would serve no purpose and that the mayor's fears were baseless. But build them he did, and the mayor was grateful. It was only years later that workmen on a high scaffold saw the columns and stopped just short of the ceiling. They were dummies, but both men got what they wanted. The mayor could relax, and Rand knew posterity would understand that his original design worked and the columns were unnecessary. The power of demonstrating your idea is that your opponents do not get defensive and are therefore more open to persuasion. Making them literally and physically feel your meaning is infidelity more powerful than an argument. Okay, so I've really been into my clean girl aesthetic lately, and I've been trying to get into my whole skincare and hair care routine, but I don't know if it's just me, but sometimes I just feel kind of skeptical about this whole custom beauty, you know. I'm sure I'm not alone. My feed sometimes feels like it's flooded, especially on TikTok, with like customize this, personalize this. And it's all promising to like fix my thinning hair or to like fix my eczema under my eyes. And then it works for someone else. And then I don't know if it works for me. But you guys, when pros says custom, they actually mean it, okay? It's no gimmick. That's why I've been kind of lately so obsessed with them, okay? Your formula literally cannot exist without you. Each and every bottle of Pros custom hair and skincare is made to order and personalize with a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients that meet your needs. They have this in-depth consultation that analyzes over 80 factors for a complete view of your life and beauty goals. It's super simple, super easy. I filled it out within 10-15 minutes, and they get so personal. I love it. Pros covers everything from your concerns to your diet, to your exercise, stress levels, to uncover what's impacting your hair and skin health. They even asked me about my zip code to better understand how the water is in my area and the air and the pollution. They even asked me if I live in the hills or not in the hills, just to better understand the pollution and exactly the location. It's so cool. I love it. Like, for example, like if you live in Brooklyn, maybe there's drier winter air versus in California. It's really cool. And next, they even recommended like this full routine of truly personalized products, which were only products after I placed my order. There's nothing pre-mixed, nothing off the shelf. It's literally after I gave all my details. And I know now from experience, they have these one-of-a-kind formulas equals one-in-a-million result. And I know from experience, one-of-a-kind formulas equal one-in-a-million results. Since I switched to Pros, I've noticed that my hair is now shinier, softer, fuller, finer instead of thin, and just stronger. But you guys, don't take my word for it, okay? In a third-party, double-blind, dermatologist-supervised, controlled clinical study, aka the gold standard in research studies, Pros has proven that personalization works better than any of these off-the-shelf alternatives, okay? So try for yourself and get your healthier hair and skin in 30 days or your money back guaranteed. Pros is so confident that you will love your results the same way I did that they are offering my listeners, my besties, an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make, okay? It's 50% off of your first subscription order. Correct, 50% at pros.com/adulting. That is PROSE.com/adulting for your free consultation plus 50% off of your one-of-a-kind formulas. You guys, you have to try it. It's honestly life-changing. Pros.com/adulting. A heckler once interrupted Nikita in the middle of a speech in which he was denouncing the crimes of Stalin. "You were a colleague of Stalin," the heckler yelled. "So why didn't you stop him then?" Nikita apparently could not see the heckler and barked out, "Who said that?" No hands went up. No one moved a muscle. After a few seconds of tense silence, Nikita finally said in a quiet voice, "Now you know why I didn't stop him." Instead of just arguing that anyone facing Stalin was afraid, knowing that the slightest sign of rebellion would mean certain death, he had made them feel what it was like to face Stalin, had made them feel the paranoia, the fear of speaking up, the terror of confronting the leader, in this case, Nikita. The demonstration was visceral and no more arguments were necessary. The most powerful persuasion goes beyond actions into symbol, the power of a symbol, a flag, a mystic story, a monument to some emotional event, is that everyone understands you without anything being said. In 1975, when Henry Kissinger was engaged in some frustrating negotiations with the Israelis over the return part of the Sinai Desert that they had seized in the 1967 war, which they won fairly, he suddenly broke off a tense meeting and decided to do some sightseeing. He paid a visit to the ruins of the ancient fortress of Masada, known to all Israelis as a place where 700 Jewish warriors committed mass suicide in AD 73, rather than give in to the Roman troops besieging them. The Israelis instantly understood the message of Kissinger's visit. He was indirectly accusing them of courting mass suicide. Although the visit did not by itself change their minds, it made them think far more seriously than any direct warning would have. Symbols like this one carry great emotional significance. When aiming for power, trying to conserve it, always look for the indirect route and also choose your battles carefully. If it does not matter in the long run whether the other person agrees with you or if time and their own experience will make them understand what you mean, then it is best to not even bother with the demonstration. Save your energy and walk away. As Benjamin Disraeli once said, never argue. In society, nothing must be discussed. Give only results. So lastly, verbal argument has one vital use in the realm of power: to distract and to cover your tracks when you're participating in deception or are caught in a lie. In such cases, it is in your advantage to argue in all the conviction that you can muster. Draw the other person into an argument to distract them from your deceptive move. When caught in a lie, the more emotional and certain you appear, the less likely it seems that you are lying. This technique has saved the hide of many con artists. Once, Count Victor Lustig, swindler per excellence, had sold dozens of stalkers around the country a phony box with which he claimed to be able to copy money. Discovering their mistake, the suckers generally chose not to go to the police. rather than risk the embarrassment of publicity. But one Sheriff Richards of Ramson County, Oklahoma, was not the kind of man to accept being conned out of $10,000. So one morning, he tracked Lustig down to a hotel in Chicago. Lustig heard a knock on the door, so when he opened it, he was looking down the barrel of a gun. "What seems to be the problem?" he calmly asked. "You son of a bitch," yelled the sheriff. "I'm going to kill you. You conned me with that damn box of yours." Lustig feigned confusion. "Wait, you mean it's not working?" he asked. "You know it's not working," replied the sheriff. "But that's impossible," said Lustig. "There's no way it couldn't be working. Did you operate it properly?" "I did exactly what you told me to do," said the sheriff. "No, you must have done something wrong," said Lustig. The argument went in circles. The barrel of the gun was gently lowered. Lustig next went to phase two in the argument tactic. He poured out a whole bunch of technical gobbles about the box's operation, completely beguiling the sheriff, who now appeared less sure of himself and argued less forcibly. "Look," said Lustig, "I'll give you your money back right now, and I'll also give you written instructions on how to work the machine. And then I'll come to Oklahoma to make sure that it's working properly. There's no way you can lose on that." The sheriff reluctantly agreed. To satisfy him completely, Lustig took out $100 bills and gave them to him, telling him to relax and have a fun weekend in Chicago. Calmer and a little confused, the sheriff finally left. Over the next few days, Lustig checked the paper every single morning. He finally found what he was looking for. A short article reporting Sheriff Richards' arrest, trial, and conviction for passing counterfeit notes. Lustig had won the argument, and the sheriff never bothered him again. So, in conclusion of this chapter, it basically trying to teach you a lesson about how to win an argument. The best way that you can win an argument is basically by showing your actions rather than your words. Because what Robert Greene is saying in the chapter is that a lot of times when you are arguing with somebody, not only can you say some words that will offend the wrong person based on whatever emotions they're experiencing or whatever they believe that you meant, but those words, there's always some misinterpretation when it comes to arguments with high emotions, but it doesn't really do you any good in the long run. So it's best to sometimes, especially if you know it's not going to benefit you, if you just argue back, there's a lot of times that you can just win those arguments through actions. But lastly, he's saying that the only time you should speak back is only when you are in the wrong and you're trying to confuse your opponent. And the more emotional and certain you appear, you know, so flustered and what? I mean, it does work. And then, you know, start to blab on the instructions by confusing your opponent, then you disarm them. So he's saying that is the only time that feels most appropriate to actually have some rebuttal and a verbal argument back. So I don't know. I really like this chapter, just something to consider. And another thing that I wanted to include that has to do with how to win an argument in general, or just in life, is law number four. Always say less than necessary. What that means is that when you're trying to impress people with words, so obviously it doesn't have to be an argument, just in general, when you're speaking to people you just met and so on, when you're trying to impress people with words, the more you say, the more common you appear and the less in control. Even if you are saying something banal, it will seem original if you make it vague, open-ended, and sphinx-like. Powerful people impress and intimidate by saying less. So the more you say, the more likely you are to say something foolish. That I agree. And I will say, I don't know if you'll say this in the chapter, but normally based on research and some stuff that I've read in the past, the only time that you should speak super fast and say a lot is if you're not sure of what you have to say and you're making things up, because then no one will catch you in that lie. And when you want to make a point, then you should speak slow and with a low voice, because that will make people listen. Because when you lower your voice, other people will stop speaking so they can hear you. I feel that I've always been super transparent and open about my struggles on this podcast with you guys and my past battles with depression, anxiety, or any lows that I've had in my life. I mean, even recently, if you listen to some of the episodes, you can tell that I was going through it. But I get back up because I stopped ignoring my pain or my sadness or my rage, and I stopped pretending it's not there. It's so important to take responsibility for your mental health, which means that bottling it up or waiting for someone else out there to save you or keeping things to yourself just doesn't cut it anymore, okay? You have to learn how to pick yourself back up. You have to learn how to save yourself. And the first step is therapy, because that's the thing about heartache and pain and loss, is that the heavier it feels, the heavier it gets, the lighter it gets when you share it. That is why I'm such a big advocate and supporter of Talkspace. They're one of my favorite sponsors, and I'm so fortunate to have them be one of the sponsors for today's episode. Talkspace has been a life changer for me, a game changer ever since I started using them, which has been a couple of years ago. Why wait? You know, there's no reason to wait. I think getting started is an important part, and Talkspace makes it so easy and so affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and you basically get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. It's incredibly convenient to have virtual sessions with a licensed therapist from the comfort of your home, which is what I do. I started using virtual sessions ever since the pandemic, and I've just been continuing to do this ever since. There's no need to commute to your appointments, and there's no need to miss time at work or line up childcare in order to attend these sessions, because it's mental health care made easy. Talkspace lets you send messages to your therapist. You don't have to wait for a next session. And Talkspace also helps you with specific challenges you might be facing. It's the number one online therapy platform with licensed therapists in over 40 specialties like anxiety, depression, substance abuse, relationship issues, and so much more. Plus, it's secure and private, and it's affordable using an in-network with most major insurers. So as a listener of my podcast and a bestie, you will get $80 off of your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/adulting, entering my promo code SPACE80. So to match with the licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/adulting and then enter my promo code SPACE80. That is SPACE80 to get $80 off of your first month. Not only do you get to show support to my show, but you get to support your own mental health, okay? That is Talkspace.com/adulting using my promo code SPACE80. So skipping some of the examples, I just want to get to the point of this law, and another time I'll get to the full chapter. So power is in many ways a game of appearances. And when you say less than necessary, you inevitably appear greater and more powerful than you are. Your silence will make other people uncomfortable. That is true. Humans are machines of interpretation and explanation. They have to know what you are thinking. When you carefully control what you reveal, they cannot pierce your intentions or your meaning. Your short answers and silences will put them on the defensive, and they will jump in, nervously filling in the silence with all kinds of comments. They will reveal valuable information about them and their weaknesses. Okay, really quick, this is Violetta speaking again. This is true. I have read in the past somewhere that if someone is lying, or if you can tell someone's not telling the truth and you want them to spill it, if you say nothing and stay silent, most of the time these people will tell on themselves, because this is true. Most people feel really uncomfortable in silence for whatever reason, especially if they're hiding something. So it's best for you to say nothing, allow them to keep speaking out of being so anxious, and eventually, like I said, they will tell on themselves. Anyway, back to the book. Saying less than necessary is not for kings and statesmen only. In most areas of life, the less you say, the more profound and mysterious you appear. This is true. As a young man, the artist, Andy Warhol, had the revelation that it was generally impossible to get people to do what you want them to do by talking to them. They would turn against you, subvert your wishes, disobey you out of sheer pettiness. He once told a friend that, "I learned that you actually have more power when you shut up." In his later life, Warhol employed the strategy with great success. His interviews were exercises in his speeches. He would say something vague and ambiguous, and then the interviewer would twist in circles, trying to figure it out, imagining there was something so profound behind his often meaningless phrases. Warhol rarely talked about his work. He let others do the interpreting. He claimed to have learned this technique from the master of Enigma, Marcel Duchamp, another 20th century artist who realized early on that the less he said about his work, the more people talked about it. And the more they talked, the more valuable his work became. By saying less than necessary, you create the appearance of meaning and power. Also, the less you say, the less risk you run of saying something foolish, even dangerous. Learn the lesson that once the words are out, you cannot take them back, so you have to keep them under control. Be particularly careful with sarcasm, especially. The momentary satisfaction that you gain with you biting words will be outweighed by the price that you will pay. Although there are times that it would be unwise to be silent. Silence can arouse suspicion and even insecurity, especially in your superiors. A vague or ambiguous comment can open you up to interpretations you had not bargained for. Silence and saying less than necessary must be practiced with caution, then and in the right situation, so be careful. It is occasionally wiser to imitate the court jester who plays the fool but knows he is smarter than the king. He talks and talks and entertains, and then no one suspects that he's more than just a fool. This is Violetta again. This is based exactly what I just told you, that when you don't know what you're talking about, it is best to speak super fast because then people will not suspect you. So he is also saying this as well here about talking and talking and entertaining. And then no, especially when you don't, like I said, when you don't know what you're talking about, because no one will suspect you that you are a fool. Also, words can sometimes act as a kind of smokescreen for any deception you might practice. By bending your listener's ear with talk, you can distract and mesmerize them. The more you talk, in fact, the less suspicious of you they become. The verbose are not perceived as sly and manipulative, but as helpless and unsophisticated. This is the reverse of the silent policy employed by the powerful. By talking more and making yourself appear weaker and less intelligent than your mark, you can then practice deception with greater ease. I agree. So I like that a lot. So lastly, Han Fei Tzu, which is a Chinese philosopher from the 3rd century BC, he said, "Never start moving your own lips and teeth before the subordinates do. The longer I keep quiet, the sooner others move their lips and teeth. As they move their lips and teeth, I can thereby understand their real intentions. The servant is not mysterious. The ministers will find opportunity to take and take." It's great. So the Chinese philosopher then said exactly what the other thing I said. When you say nothing and you allow the other person to speak, a lot of the times, especially if they're suspicious of something, they will get anxious and they will tell on themselves. So I hope you learn from both of these quick little chapters that I shared with you today, the two laws. And I hope you will now, you know, win arguments. Choose your words wisely. Like my mom said in the past, because I sometimes used to, still do sometimes, how I'm impulsive. And sometimes I say things that I later regret. My mom always said, "Words are like birds. Once you release them, they're out in the world and there's nothing you can do to catch them again." So you say one thing, it takes you 2 seconds, and then it's going to take you years on years to salvage that bridge, if you even can. So think about that. I think my mother also once said, "You are born unable to speak, and then you will spend the rest of your life trying to learn how to shut up." Anyway, guys, thank you so much for listening to another Tuesday episode of Benson Book Club. I hope you enjoyed what we read today. So again, this was from the book, The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene. I love you, and I will see you Thursday. Bye.